Hello, my name is Mike Diedrich. I'm a member of Veterans for Peace Chapter 92, Daniel Ellsberg Chapter now. We're going to be talking about that new renaming. And we have a upcoming event June 15th, which will be a longer, much longer program on Daniel Ellsberg, including Patricia Ellsberg, Daniel Ellsberg's wife, a movie, and other things. I'll read the statement of Daniel Ellsberg's legacy. Once in a while, somebody with courage and conscience rises from obscurity to change the course of history. Daniel Ellsberg was one of those people. After serving in the United States Marine Corps, he became an analyst of the RAND Corporation. While there, he helped write a report on the Vietnam War, commissioned by Robert McNamara, Secretary of Defense. Completed in 1968, the report delivered a damning indictment of American involvement in that conflict, revealing decades of lying to the American people and even to congressional leaders regarding why we were fighting, what we were actually doing there, and how the war was going for the United States and our allies in Vietnam. Rather than taking heed of this message, two successive administrations shrouded the report in secrecy while continuing to pursue a failed military strategy. Dismayed by this regard of the reality we faced in Vietnam, Mr. Ellsberg leaked the top secret study to the news media, convinced that the American people deserved to know the truth about the war. He hoped by doing so, our leaders would be held accountable for their decisions and the war that was ravaging Vietnam and taking the lives of countless civilians could sooner be brought to an end. The report, soon dubbed the Pentagon Papers, had a profound effect on popular opinion and our representatives in Congress. They later cut off funding for the Vietnam War and exacted legislation to rein in the president's authority to wage war without congressional approval. Mr. Ellsberg knew his whistleblowing would end his career as a government consultant and likely result in a long prison sentence as well. But he did it anyway out of concern for his country that had blundered its way into a futile military adventure halfway around the world. The Nixon administration went on into overdrive in a ham-fisted attempt to silence him and punish him for speaking out. First, they sued to keep the Pentagon Papers from being published at all, only to lose in a landmark Supreme Court decision, establishing a very high bar for prior restraint of the news media by court order. Next, they labeled Ellsberg the most dangerous man in America and attacked him with an array of legal and illegal strategies in an ev effort to destroy his reputation and lock him up for espionage. The attempt backfired. The judge threw out the case due to numerous irregularities and illegal acts of the overzealous men doing the president's bidding. President Nixon eventually resigned in lieu of being impeached and convicted of various crimes associated with the Watergate scandal. Ellsberg spent the rest of his life serving the people as a tireless advocate for peace and reconciliation, a defender of the First Amendment rights, and a champion for nuclear disarmament. Drawing on his expertise as a strategic nuclear analyst at the RAND Corporation, he warned the nation and the world of the existential threat that our nuclear weapons policy posed to all humanity, a policy he condemned as being immoral and insane. He will long be remembered as a true American patriot who had the courage to speak truth to power, whatever the consequences, in his quest to uphold the ideals upon which our nation was founded. His legacy will be a clarion call for each of us to further this mission, doing our small part to speak out against evil, defend our constitutional rights, and petition for peace. To honor Mr. Ellsberg's work and promote his lasting legacy, the Seattle Chapter 92 of Veterans for Peace, with the permission of the Ellsberg family, has been renamed Veterans for Peace, Daniel Ellsberg Chapter 92, Seattle. I just want to also add that I didn't do in the introduction that this is going to be broadcast on KODX 96.9 FM. It will also be archived there and also on VFP92.org website. So Kim, who's Kim Hunter is with me today, and also Daniel Gilman, and we're going to talk to have some comments on that legacy statement and Daniel Ellsberg in general. So go ahead, Kim.
Well, thank you, Mike. Daniel Ellsberg has been a familiar name with me almost my entire adult life. And I remember now very clearly when I first heard his name, because he was a totally obscure person. No one outside of his family and friends had ever heard of him and work colleagues until June 1971, when all of us, in short order, a series of papers were published in the New York Times and the Washington Post and then other newspapers condemning the Vietnam War and telling the truth about the failures of our policies there and all the casualties that were occurring because of that. The reason I remember it so well is because in June 71 is because that was the month I returned from my second tour in Vietnam. I went to my second tour in Vietnam under protest because of what I personally witnessed on my first tour in Vietnam. I explained to the Pentagon in very distinct terms, I explained my moral opposition to the war and told them that I should not be sent over there as an officer in a combat role or any other role because of my moral organization. It was not safe for my men to have someone morally opposed to the war under their command. That effort and other efforts failed, and I did go. And when I went the second time, it was a very difficult experience for me because I saw what I saw a little of the first tour. I saw a whole bunch more of the second tour. It confirmed my suspicions of what I thought was happening in the first tour. So when I came back, I was depressed. I was guilt-ridden. I was angry. And I was just basically dissociated from society. I wasn't a very good person to live with for a few years. One of the things I did, and actually I had PTSD, although I didn't know it, the name hadn't even been invented at the time. So I stayed away from most news about the Vietnam War because, as it turns out, that was the trigger. It just made my situation worse, except when I started reading the Pentagon Papers, I did pay close attention to that because here was a guy who stepped out of obscurity and exposed the things that I had learned in the war or suspected about the war, and actually confirmed it. He was in the room where these decisions were being made. And so I was not very surprised by what I read. I was a little surprised by the extent of what was going on. And I thought mainly that our decisions were being made over there because our leadership was more or less stupid or clueless. But I was a little surprised to find out the depths of the deception and the lies that went back for decades. So it really filled in a lot of gaps for me, and it really vindicated me for the position I had taken with respect to the war. So I followed what he was doing for years after that off and on. His name would go in and out of the press. I had the, and I will just skip forward to about 25 or 30 years. It was in the middle 80s, late 80s, early 90s, right along there. After the Vietnam experience, I had the good luck to listen to him speak at a large book fair in Seattle. It was conducted at the former Sandpoint Naval Air Station at the NOAA facility. It was a gigantic warehouse and stages where all manner of literary productions were being presented and discussed. And he was the keynote speaker. I was really spellbound by the sincerity of his convictions, how articulate he was about explaining the evils of our nuclear proliferation policy. I had not read closely what he was reading about. I just knew that he was an advocate for nuclear disarmament and was working real hard on that. But to hear him speak in person about the insanity and the immorality of our nuclear weapons policy was just, I was just really struck by that. And I was really glad that we had folks like that championing the cause of peace. I'll jump forward to 2017. It wasn't long after that that I read his book. It was his last book, I believe, The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner. And what he talked about at his speech in Seattle, he really elucidated in far greater detail and depth in the book. And I just considered it like the manual for anybody. It's a must read for anybody who is concerned about our nuclear weapons proliferation and what might be done to stop it. And the reason it's so poignant is that he wasn't just on the outside complaining and saying what he thought was going on. He was the guy in the room. He was a nuclear war planner working for the U.S. government, helping to create nuclear weapons policy back in the 60s. And he was horrified by what he discovered, how precarious our situation is now, to have this much weaponry under our control and yet to have such expansive authority to use this weaponry, that he felt that really it's only a matter of time before someone pushes the wrong button, and here we are in a new global thermonuclear war. It was probably the most frightening book I'd ever read because it was so real, and I could see that, you know, this was something that everybody who has a conscience and cares about the future of our planet needs to pay closer attention to. And the last vignette is the months leading up to his death. He was a champion for peace right to the very end. Even when he was far along with his disease, he spent as much time as he could really being a leader and a champion and passing on his wisdom to other folks in the hopes that other people would follow in his footsteps and speak truth to power, work towards world peace. And basically, you know, that people just needed to step out of their comfort zone to do the right thing, to try to set our world again. So his life, from my entire adult period of my life, is a great role model and a great, great role model for me. I have nothing but great admiration for him. And I'm just delighted that our Seattle chapter of Veterans for Peace will be changing our name of our chapter to include his name so that we can honor his legacy in that manner.
Cam, thanks for that. I quickly, you know, we're all three Vietnam veterans. You mentioned the first tour and second tour. You saw things in the second tour that you didn't notice in the first tour. What, I mean, without being too lengthy, can you give a short summary of what that was?
Well, the first tour, I was resupplying our forward stations up and down the coast. So I would go in and I would, our ship would deliver 1,000 tons of war material, most of it close to the, just south of the DMZ. So I would see I would not see personally the war going on except for the ships and the planes. The ships and the planes were flying all over the place, dropping all manner of weaponry. Things were lighting up. You could see that from time to time. And our naval gunfire from the DMZ to the inland of Vietnam was just shocking, really. There was the USS New Jersey. They were the big guns with the 16-inch guns, just volley after volley after volley, just randomly chewing up the countryside inside of Vietnam. shooting it. I don't even know what they're shooting. I don't even know if we knew what they were shooting at, but they certainly were doing a lot of damage. And of course, a lot of that weaponry, a lot of the UXO is in the ground today. I didn't see the difference between that and the second tour was that I had heard about what was going on in country from a lot of other officers who I'd meet at in social occasions and this sort of thing. And I couldn't find an officer over there who'd been there very long who actually believed in what we were doing. They were all pretty disgusted, the ones I talked to. And so when I got back, then I was first in Da Nang in a small boat repair facility, but then we moved to the Mekong River on the Cambodian border. So we were right in the thick of war operation in that area. There weren't many people who welcomed us in that area. We had to put up some extreme, take some extreme defensive measures to protect ourselves. And in the process, it turns out there was collateral damage. So we were involved in operations that ended up in the death of innocent people. And not only that, being on the Mekong River, there were bodies floating down the river every day. It was a grotesque scene that you just couldn't get used to. Something like that left an imprint on your brain that you cannot forget. I'm not saying all those deaths were our fault, but there was a whole lot of killing going on. And I'm sad to say that most of those dying were Vietnamese, Cambodian, the Laotian citizens, women and children in many cases.
Okay, thanks for that, Kevin. I want a personal note. As far as I'm concerned, it took me a while to sort of process that after I got back from Vietnam. I got back from Vietnam in late 1968, but I went through the Tet Offensive and the May Offensive. And for me, this most single event was the, we had a village right next to our door during the May Offensive, May 7th. There was some fire from some probably infiltrators in the infiltrators, the NLF infiltrators. And we came back with everything we had, Sky Raiders, F-4s, F-100s, and they dropped white phosphorus, 250, 500-pound bombs, gunships. And the net result of that was one of our, when I was an interrogator, one of our fellow interrogators, he says, there was probably about 200 innocents that died in that two-hour thing. And you know, we were loading bodies into dump trucks and things like that. Some of them came to our compound, and we couldn't help them because we didn't have any morphine. You know, they were burned in shrapnel. So that single event was, although I saw a bunch of things, I remember sitting in a what they call a fire basin, an NDP with the 1st Infantry, and looking up the night sky and seeing the guy next to me in the foxhole pointed out, you could see those 16-inch projectiles going through the night sky. I mean, they weren't that fast, but they were like a small, looked like a Volkswagen up there. They have a thing called in the military H&I fire, which is called a harassment and interdiction fire. And, you know, I probably provided some of those coordinates for where we should fire that. But, you know, all it meant was, you know, they're killing civilians, water buffaloes and dogs and pigs as far as trying to stop infiltration, it was hopeless failure. Mostly just a lot of people were killed. So anyway, and I too came back with PTSD because of that. And it was like a revelation when I got back and nobody was talking about this. You know, it says, well, this is what we were doing, what the news media were saying. And what we were actually doing there was so far apart that, so that's why Ellsberg's expose is so important. He laid it all out with a very meticulous report. Interesting enough, it was commissioned by Robert McNamara, one of the architects of the war. So, Dan, you got something else that can add to this Ellsberg narrative?
Well, not anywhere near the detail that Kim has outlined. I haven't worked up my talk yet, but I plan to talk about how Daniel Ellsberg was a soldier, like we were in the in the war there, and then became a veteran. And he was, you know, he was advisor, VFP advisor for the national organization. And just talk about how he connects with his military duty that he did, and some of ours, especially when we'll be talking about how he, when he came back from the war, I mean, he was disillusioned by the fact that the war was not going well, and became to believe that, you know, we could win. And of course, a lot of people were saying that. But, you know, he still for a long time thought that, you know, he could do something to help change that and turn this into some kind of. But when he got back, he started listening to his listening to the anti-war movement, and I mean, and Patricia had some responsibility and for helping him change his mind about war and becoming a peacemaker. But there's a similarity there to my experience of coming back and then listening to the anti-war folks and realizing how wrong I was and and how wrong the war was. So that's part of what I want to talk about. But there's a lot more in Daniel's life that, you know, that we can talk about. I mean, his courage in exposing the lies and the reports of how the war was going and what they were saying behind the American people's back and what was actually happening. So, and then probably touch on a little later in his life, where he talks about, or where he was a nuclear war planner, and something about that. I wanted to make sure that was covered, and Kim covers some of that, so I probably will not do too much there. But I guess we need to hear what you might be planning, what you're thinking about talking about, and you know, and then if there's other things that we need to identify to talk about, then we can discuss that as well.
Yeah, sure. I was wondering, you know, what sort of connection or awareness did you have of the Pentagon Papers outside of a general sort of disillusionment with the war after you got back to, what was your sort of earliest that you remember sort of specific connection with Ellsberg and the Pentagon Papers?
Yeah, it was quite a bit later. I was had changed my mind about the war and listening to the anti-war folks, and it was, I mean, I certainly in the news I saw about Daniel Ellsberg and him and the Pentagon Papers, but I really hadn't listened close and enough to the what the anti-war folks were saying to begin this transformation. But once I did get a chance to read about him and the Pentagon Papers. It just confirmed and strengthened the anti-war position that I adopted in wanting to make and wanting to become a peacemaker and oppose the wars and all wars that the U.S. Does around the world. So it became a important example to me later in my development as a anti-war activist.
Should mention that sort of due to circumstances and the criminal behavior of the president of the time, Richard Nixon, he avoided actually going to jail. He probably would still be in jail had not that sort of the circumstances. And there's a notable example of Chelsea and Bradley Manning, who he as a she, he spent 5 or 6 years in jail, and Assange is still in the jail. My personal connection with this sort of thing was I'd like sort of talk about the what the Pentagon Papers, some of the specifics of the Pentagon Papers, and how that information got there. And my job in the military was as an interrogator analyst. I was trained originally as an analyst, and then after I finished that 5 month course, they said, "Well, you're going to be an interrogator," and they sent me to a 6 week course, and okay, you're changed my MOS. But what really affected me most was that the information that I and the other low level intelligence people, I mean, I was an E5, Spec 5, and the information we got from prisoners was fairly straightforward, and that was information what size the units were, where they were, and that information was passed on to combat units and like CAMS units and other infantry units that go and chase NLF soldiers and try and kill them. But the information that I got was sent up to MACV. Our unit was actually a MACV unit, and that the order of battle information was sent up directly to William Mac Westmoreland. And it was fairly accurate as to what the number of people that were out there who were combat ready, and where they were, and that sort of thing. Westmoreland said, "Well, that's about 50,000 too many people that are combat capable." So they reduced the number. And it was and his chief of staff, gotta think of it. The American general in charge of intelligence told Westmoreland, he says, "You're keeping double books on this. This isn't right." So Westmoreland said, "You're going home." He kicked him out of the country and sent him to the Pentagon for another job. So basically, that information was kept from the president. And also, it literally, when the shit hit the fan, that is in the Tet Offensive and May Offensive in particular, when there was 40 or 50,000 soldiers hit every provincial capital and district capital in Vietnam, and almost every American unit and allied unit. And they said, "Well, Jesus Christ, where did all these people come from?" And so the answer was, they were there all along. So that's sort of lying. And Westmoreland is right in the middle of it. And Johnson was too. I mean, that was one of my disillusionment. It was very, and that was the background for some of the reporting in the Pentagon Papers, which is why it was such a shock to everybody. But I mean, what the Pentagon Papers showed was that there was a systematic system of lying to the American public. It started with the field generals, particularly all the way up to MACV to Westmoreland to the department. So they knew what was going on, but they decided to keep continuing the war. West or not Westmoreland, but Johnson said, and it was this about 67 or so, 68. At that time, there were about 30 some thousand American dead. And he says, "Well, what about all those? Why can't you stop the war now? What about all those boys that have died?" And it, as one, there was a VFP poster, and it says, "The best way to do that is cut and run. You
Mm-hmm.
know, you're not gonna provide any honor in the dead of those on the graves of those dead by adding another 15,000. You know, the other thing is that, you know, the wasn't necessarily mentioned in the Pentagon Papers, but it should be that number should be 60,000 at least, and that you know, it's two or three or four times that people number of people of Americans that have died since the war related to the directly war related to the war, and probably hundreds of thousands of Vietnamese. So I would just talk about that sort of part of the Pentagon Papers and what it did reveal that people didn't know about specifically. So, which is quite a bit, actually.
Yeah.
I think I mentioned that there's going to be a movie and associated with this June 15th, and that VFP 92, Daniel Ellsberg chapter, we'll have probably in the next couple of days a flyer which would be available on our website, which will outline the program that we're going to be presenting. So is there anything else that we should be saying about this, at least as far as our presentations? Dan, do you think that we need a little bit more comprehensive outline and which we can do as far as what we're going to say? We've got what our piece of the program is, what, about an hour? Or no, 30 minutes?
Yeah, 30 minutes.
30 minutes, well, that's not much. You know, you could just sit around and talk back and forth and do that easily.
I think we want to not just we have our stories about our experience and what all went on. As we talk about those, I think we want to intentionally talk about, how that reflects on, the character of Daniel Ellsberg and why those characteristics or those things that he did are something that we value and want to see in our chapter, and make that connection between the stories we tell and the examples we have from the Pentagon Papers or just in his other parts of his life that people will be able to understand why we felt it important to and wanted to change our name to Daniel Ellsberg chapter.
Well, it's an honor, really, and I would just mention, I don't know if it mentioned in the essay on the legacy essay, but Daniel Ellsberg, as a soldier, took the same oath of office, if you want to call it that, enlistment, and it says, "I will defend our Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic, among other things." And he took that seriously, and I think that most of the people in Veterans for Peace, realize that that's a moral and obligation that we'd like to live up to, actually an obligation. I certainly felt that way, you know. There's no other way to. I mean, Daniel Ellsberg, I'm sure, talked about that or thought about that himself, and that led to his participation in releasing the Pentagon Papers. Go ahead, Kim.
Yeah, what I can, one of the things I can point out specifically, Dan, in my presentation is how courageous his act was by comparing with me, because The similarity is this, is that I also was horrified by what I experienced in the war, and I was courageous enough to write a letter and do some other things to try to get out of going to the war. And for, as I pointed out in my, in the legacy statement, that act that Daniel Ellsberg took, whistleblowing, was the end of his career as a government consultant. And my protesting the war was the end of my career as someone who was trained for a career as a naval officer. But he went on to risk going to prison. And I considered going to prison, but I could not do that because my wife had just given birth to a child, and she was letting me know that she wouldn't be there for me when I got out of jail if I did that. So I could not make that decision. So, you know, it's kind of like behind every good man stands a good woman. I got no support from my wife, got no support from my father, who's a career naval officer. He never understood why I was opposed to the war. So I stood all alone. And, anyway, it's not about me. I'm not going to go into that much detail, but I can point out how the stop on the courageous part. So the main themes of his character that I will dwell on then will be the courageousness of his initial act, and then the longevity of his career that he kept working as a peace act advocate and an advocate for nuclear disarmament his entire life. He was relentless. And those are the two attributes that I would like to focus on.
Good.
Well, I think he was lucky in a way, considering his proclivity for being outspoken, was that he was the architect, if you want to call it, of the release of the Pentagon Papers. And fortunately, he didn't go to jail, which would have stifled him quite a bit. But he was able to use this notoriety, which is tremendous notoriety, to continue peace activism and being outspoken. And in that respect, he was very lucky to have that sort of opportunity. You know, as an ex E5 soldier, and I joined the Vietnam Veterans Against the War very shortly after I got out, my motivation was how stupid we were and how ruthless we were. And actually, my opposition to the war was rooted in a substantial amount of anger. I suspect that Daniel Ellsberg, I don't know, I haven't read his book, that he was angry about what we were doing, and that was part of his motivation for being an activist. You read the book, Dan?
Yeah. While he was over there, he became disillusioned and angry because the war wasn't, you know, being prosecuted as he thought they should. You know, he was over there with Lansbury, who did the Hearts and Minds program in the Philippines, but they were supposed to be doing it in Vietnam. But of course, you know, they had these free fire zones and displaced everybody to camps, and, you know, burned down their houses, their thatched roofed houses, and, you know, just everything that you wouldn't do if you were really trying to win hearts and minds. But you know, when he realized, you know, read the Pentagon's papers from front to back, you know, he was just infuriated at the amount of lies and deceptions that the government was hoisting on the American people. That was part of the reason he, because he wanted, he, he said he, you know, he wanted to shorten the war. He wanted to end the war. And so he knew he had to do that, even though he might spend the rest of his life in jail. And, you know, the journalists always asked him, why did you leak the Pentagon Papers if you were, you know, and risk spending the rest of your life in jail? And his answer was a rhetorical question. Wouldn't you do the same if you could end the war? You know? And he became thoroughly disgusted what the government, U.S. government, was doing there and how they were doing it.
It's kind of interesting to me because I wasn't aware of some of his personal life, that his wife was influential in changing his perception and views on the war. And that was before he actually released the Pentagon Papers, I assume. Yeah,
she was a journalist and she was covering the anti-war rallies. First time they met at a party, he asked her out for a date.
Yeah.
And she said, you know, the next day. And she said, no, I got to go cover this anti-war rally. You're welcome to come along. But no, I've got to go cover this. Because she had a radio program in New York about, you know, it's not just about the war, but just issues of the day and stuff. And so she was a pretty well-known reporter. And, at one point she asked him, how can you be involved in this stuff? And he tried to explain, you know, how he was trying to, you know, get the military to see, you know, how they were was wrong and how they should be proceeding. And, you know, that was in his phase when he still thought there was hope to make something out of this war.
And he was still in uniform at the time? Or just a consultant?
I'm not sure if he was or not, but yeah, I think he was, actually. I think he was. Because she went over to visit him in Vietnam several times while he was in, you know, in service there.
And, really?
It really just about broke up their relationship. And it wasn't till, I don't know, about, I think a year later before they kind of got back together. But yeah, I think she was a big influence on him.
Well, it's kind of interesting, some of the remarks that, I mean, when I came back and I was sitting down with my parents in their living room, I was still in uniform. And one of the first things, my mother, who was a school teacher, a very smart woman, she just blurted it out. She blurted it out, says, now, are you a war criminal? And
she, oh, geez.
You know, my dad said, oh, wait a minute. And I said, well, you know, I was, you know, because I was there and I was a part of the war, you know, you could make the logical assumption that maybe I was. But she knew that I was an interrogator and said, well, you know, I didn't beat people up. We didn't do that sort of thing, at least in my unit. Not that the Arvin and everybody else didn't, but, you know, she'd been watching the news and she knew what a mess it was. You know, it's not an unreasonable question to ask a son who was in military intelligence if you're not a war criminal. So I know that, I mean, another personal thing, I only did sort of recent recollection of what a stress this was on my mother and my dad and my sister and my brother. Was over, because when I was there, the Tet Offensive and May Offensive, and it was just a big, long, 6-month mess. And of course, you'd send back letters saying, "Well, I'm okay." And one of the first things our CEO did was after the Tet Offensive is everybody write a letter saying that they're okay.
Oh, gee.
So, you know, the chapter is really is doing itself proud by taking the name and also carrying on the legacy as best we can of Ellsberg and his courageous stand. I hope this is not going to be the end of it, really, but I think we should probably post this and have stuff available on the website. About Daniel Ellsberg and links to his writing, that sort of thing, which people could look at and read. In addition to, he's probably had half a dozen or at least a dozen articles in various national newspapers. Some of those are better than others, but we can actually make that make an effort to put those essays available to everybody. Not a lot of people in this country knew who Daniel Ellsberg was, or for that matter, how important the Pentagon Papers was. And that's going to be a part of our job as Veterans for Peace to make sure that is more widely known. So hopefully maybe this little snippet of radio will help boost our show. And the show is going to be actually on a Zoom function,
yes.
Just like this.
Yeah, Saturday, June 15th at 10 o'clock.
So are we going to...
Flyer will have the link to the event.
Well, now, if it's Zoom, you actually have the option, as this piece does, of doing audio and video. I would think that we could probably make that to both options available. It'd be sort of a long program, but nonetheless.
It'll be video.
Okay.
Because we're showing the movie and having some other. We're going to pay it. Play a trailer right at the beginning of the event, and then go into,
and
us doing presentations and stuff.
And that video would be actually posted, or a link to it would be posted on our website.
I'm sorry, say again.
That video of our conference, the 15th, would be available through our website with a link or something like that.
Well, you mean the recording of it?
Recording or video too.
Well, yeah, I think so. I'll have to talk to the tech guys, but
like an MP3 video, link. It would be probably something that's going to be several hours long. I don't know if we at the end product, we might need to edit that down to make it a little bit more user friendly.
Well, it's, the program is an hour, and then the movie is an hour and a half.
Okay, well, that's not that long. Yeah, okay.
So, we'll have a break between the two, but we'll go right into the movie.
Great. We're just about out of time as far as, aren't we? We've got, let's see, 1:15, about 55 minutes. Any other late comments we need to make about Ellsberg for now? Yeah. Well, okay, great. This is Mike Diedrich. For the Veterans for Peace Now, Daniel Ellsberg, Chapter 92, KODX 96.9. And as mentioned earlier, this program, our little short program here, promotional program really for the June 15th larger Veterans for Peace program on Daniel Ellsberg will be available on the radio station, and also the chapter will have it's actually posted on its website. So
VFP92.org.
VFP92.org. I don't know if we're going to have to change that to squeeze Daniel Ellsberg in there, but we'll talk about that later, I guess. So that'll be all for now, at least as far as this is. Thank you.